It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Hi, friends. This is Kurt Frankum with the Leading LDS Podcast. Back again. I'm trying to release these episodes every Tuesday. Well, these How I Lead episodes every Tuesday. You get one a week. Always have something to look forward to. And I really want to have more sisters on this. Okay, so if you have a fantastic Relief Society president, I want to have more sisters than men, brethren, on this podcast. And so please, if you have a great Relief Society president, primary president, whoever it is, just a nice old lady in the ward who's a leader without a calling, let's get her on the program. Okay, it's going to be fantastic. But today, another episode of How I Lead, we're interviewing Adam Barrow. Lives in the Salt Lake City area, grew up in these parts, but has nonetheless traveled and lived in San Francisco, in Raleigh, North Carolina area, and has served as Elders Quorum President. He's currently the Secretary in the Elders Quorum Presidency, has served as Executive Secretary and Counselor in the Elders Quorum, and so he's got a great perspective on seeing an Elders Quorum not only run in Salt Lake City, but in North Carolina and San Francisco, and had some great concepts, very thorough leadership points, which I was excited to talk to him about. He had quotes, scriptures, and which I'll post all of that so that you can read up on your own, and great episode. So here's my interview with Adam Barrow. I have Adam Barrow with us. How are you, Adam?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Good. You know, you're definitely one of my favorite listeners out there because, I don't know, what was it? A few months ago, you emailed me, we emailed back and forth, and you said, hey, let's go to lunch. And you were kind enough to buy me lunch, and we chatted and got to know each other. And it was like, wow, like somebody other than my mom that's listening. This is fantastic. So I appreciate that.
You're welcome. I was glad to be able to connect with you and meet you in person.
Yeah. And if there's anybody else, you know, in the Salt Lake or Wasatch front that wants to get together, like, I'd love to just go to lunch, and you don't have to pay if you don't want to. Of course, I never turn down a free lunch, but it's always fun to just kind of hear how you're receiving leading LDS and hear your ideas and so forth. So I appreciate it, Adam. And as we were meeting, I, of course, didn't let you get out of there without committing to a How I Lead interview, and that's why we're here today. So,
yeah, no, this is great.
Cool. So, where you're living in Salt Lake, right? Or where exactly do you live?
Yeah, that's correct. It's Cottonwood Heights, just a little bit south of Salt Lake.
Nice area. And were you born and raised in Salt Lake area?
Yep, I was born in the Midvale, Murray area. Where I was born and raised, technically born out in West Jordan, but yeah, I spent most of my life here in the Salt Lake Valley.
Cool. And your career and education is taking all over the place. Where are some of the places you've lived?
So I went to BYU, graduated in accounting. I worked for one of the large accounting firms. So I started my career out in the Bay Area in California. Loved it out there. And then family reasons, we headed out east to North Carolina, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Wow.
Spent some time out there. Loved it. And then both my wife and I are from here. So we thought maybe we should try to get the grandkids a little bit closer to the grandparents. And now we're back. We've been back in Utah for just a couple of years now.
Yeah. Wow. Now, you explained to me during our lunch that you met your wife in junior high. Is that right?
Yes, that is
your
correct.
Junior high sweethearts. That's cute.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We go back a ways.
Cool. And, so in your upbringing, how would you describe your upbringing? Pretty typical for Salt Lake, Mormon boy?
Yep. Born and raised, several generations removed from our first generation that was converted to the church. So yeah, typical Utah, Salt Lake Valley, Mormon upbringing, I guess.
Cool. Right on. And then you later went on a mission.
Yes, I actually served a mission in San Francisco.
Very nice.
So it was a great experience, English speaking, but it's as foreign as you can get without leaving the country. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that part's just another melting pot of the country. I remember in my mission in Sacramento, which isn't too far from San Francisco, obviously, we had 8 different languages spoken in our, mission that elders would learn. I would imagine it was very similar, if not more, would you say?
Very similar. Yep, exactly.
Cool. Yep. Nice. And then come over from the mission, go to college and into accounting, and then that took you in various parts of the country, like you mentioned, right?
Exactly. Yep.
Cool. And now how would you describe the phase of life that you're living in right now? You sent me this picture that was full of children. Are they all your children in that picture?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Just kind of in the middle of my career, middle of raising a family. We've got 5 kids, a boy, 3 girls, and another boy.
Wow.
So it's never a dull moment. Hands are always full, and we're having a lot of fun.
So you're about halfway to 10 kids then, huh?
That you can say that. If my wife had her way, we'd have 10 kids. I'm a little more hesitant about that, but that's okay.
Nice. We'll negotiation happening there, just like exactly. In most families. Well, cool. Now, you have served in various elder quorum callings. You're currently the elders quorum secretary, but you've been an elders quorum president in the past and counselor, even had a stint as an executive secretary. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Yes. With all the moves, it's led to a lot of different callings, different exposure to leadership positions in various parts of the country. So it's been a great ride and great experience serving in the church and interacting with a whole lot of different people.
Cool. And that's what I'm excited to kind of get into is it's not been in the same ward, in Utah, or there's probably been some unique culture differences as you've served in North Carolina and San Francisco, and probably taken different lessons from those experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just from having the different or a larger cross section of the demographics, being in an area like North Carolina, where our ward was, it's nothing like Alaska. I mean, it was about a 30-minute drive from top to bottom, but you get a lot of different people from a lot of different walks. So I think that just leads to a vast amount of experiences you can have.
Cool. Now, where should we start then? Is it were you an elders quorum counselor first before you became an elders quorum president? I think that's how I remember you telling me the story.
Yeah, that's right. We had just moved out to North Carolina, the cross country trip from California out to North Carolina. When I got there, it was only just a month or two removed from when they reorganized the elders quorum presidency. So I was called into the elders quorum presidency as a second counselor, and got to serve with an excellent elders quorum president. He was able to, he offered some great training that I really appreciated in my church service career, if you will. But we were only an elders quorum presidency for about, I don't know, maybe 6, maybe 9 months. And then they reorganized the stake, and I was pulled into a different ward. And I was only there for a month or so when they, the elders quorum president in that ward moved out. And so they called me in as the elders quorum presidency there, or as the elders quorum president.
Oh, okay. So that was due to a splitting of a stake.
Yep. Exactly.
Oh, cool. Now you mentioned this great training that you got from the elders quorum president. How would you maybe articulate that more? What made it good training? How did he go about training you? Was it mainly just by example, or was he running a presidency meeting where these principles were going, he was going over certain training principles, or how would you articulate that training?
So a lot of it was just his ministry, if you will. He certainly trained us out of the handbook. He had just come from serving, I think, as the secretary of the stake with the stake president. And so he's very in tune with what the stake presidency was looking for and expecting. And so when he got there, I mean, he was just I'm adamant about getting out and meeting with the members of the quorum, especially trying to get a feel for where they are at and trying to bring the unity to the quorum. And so I enjoyed being able to just go out on visits with him and with the other members of the presidency. We got to meet some great people and learn from them and hopefully teach some. And I think just that whole aspect of just trying to interact with people and being focused on the members of the quorum really made it just a quality experience.
Nice. And so obviously he sounds like a very proactive Elder Quorum president. I mean, not that there's too many, non-proactive Elder Quorum presidents, but just being engaged a lot of the time, you're able to pick up a lot of what he was doing.
Absolutely. It was a great precedent to be able to look to and an experience for sure.
Cool. And your statement about him being in tune with the stake president, obviously having that calling prior to, you know, serving with the stake president as his secretary prior to being called as Elder Quorum president, kind of an interesting perspective. And I know in my calling as a counselor in the stake presidency, we, even last night, we were just talking about, you know, how often do we need to meet with the Elder Quorum presidents and high priest group leaders and you know, how involved should we be there? But I think obviously from your experience, it's only going to help the Elder Quorum president if he finds an opportunity to go to the stake president and say, hey, like, you know, what can I do to be more in tune with what you're trying to do and take that stake message to the ward? Because obviously Elder Quorum president is a stake calling, right?
Right.
Obviously serving the ward. So I don't know, interesting thought there. And he obviously had a easy way of doing that, but maybe there's other opportunities for stake presidents to understand the message of the stake president.
Yeah, no, I must say our stake presidency, they were, of course, very, very proactive, wanting to, I mean, they gave us a lot of space to you know, run our elders' quorum and at least minister to the needs and you know, because, I mean, it's a large stake that covers a large geographical area. So you have different needs in the different locations, but they provided some great trainings and love to go out and do visits with us, and just so they can get to know the members of the ward and throughout the stake.
Cool. Now, as you were, how long was it that you were a counselor and then made until the split happened and you were made Elder Quorum president?
Yeah, I want to say, I mean, it was definitely less than a year, maybe 6 to 9 months or so.
And as you were now set apart as the Elder Quorum president, any specific things that you definitely, you know, programs or tactics that you took from that Elder Quorum president and made sure you established in your quorum?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wish I could say it was a perfect presidency. We were on top of the ball and on top of our game for everything. But you know, we really tried to just try to get out, make those visits, try to understand and the needs of the people. So when I was there, the ward I got pulled into, we covered downtown Raleigh. So there's a lot of welfare needs that we had to deal with, and the bishop really put a lot on us to help him, you know, ease his burden just because of everything that he would have to deal with in that regard. And so, you know, a lot of it was very reactive when crisis would emerge. And so we had to learn how to, you know, help people understand where the self-reliance comes into play and where we can help them as from a church perspective, but ultimately we're there to help them spiritually. And so, and it was tough too, because we had, our home teaching companionships, get just the numbers in our ward, we had about, I mean, it was not atypical to have 8 to 10 families assigned to a companionship. And so, you know, trying to get 100% every month was pretty unrealistic, but we just try to block and tackle and try to at least reach out to those that had the highest needs and realize that, hey, as an Elders Quorum president or the Elders Quorum presidency, we may not necessarily need to have a visit every month. And so it was a lot of adaptation that we had to work through and try to figure out.
Hmm. And you've talked about this, it covered a as far as the geography or demographics of the ward, covered a large area in North Carolina, which included downtown Raleigh. So, which led to maybe some inner city, more poverty areas. and so higher welfare. Is that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, and it was kind of interesting just because our ward, I mean, I had a good cross section. So we had, you know, very affluent homes, but also, I mean, it was a little bit more.
Sure.
You know, the welfare needs downtown for sure.
Okay. And what were some of those tasks that, what was your role in some of those welfare tasks that the bishop was delegating to you, and how did he delegate that to you?
So, I mean, if people came to him with specific needs, he'd just tell us, you know, you as the Elders' Quorum Presidency, either work with the home teachers or as yourself, go and help them, you know, understand just the principles of budgeting. We'd even do, you know, food orders or trying to understand those kind of needs and report back to the bishop. And then he'd figure out or final, make the final assessment on where the church resources would go.
Oh, cool. And so you're in these homes a lot, kind of doing the accounting, which you're obviously good at, to help these individuals or families see what the next step is and what their plan of self-reliance.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, he utilized all the members of the ward council. The Relief Society president obviously was heavily involved in those kind of tasks too, but he just have to divide and conquer and split it up.
Cool. Oh, interesting. Now, so from there, that's after North Carolina, you went to Utah. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. Quite a culture shock, if you will, going from the South to the Wasatch Front.
Right.
We miss our days in North Carolina. It was the people there. I mean, especially in the church, you have a lot of people coming from Utah, or a lot of them actually were born and raised there. So you kind of got a good flavor of you know, just different perspectives of the church culture and upbringing.
And
we really appreciate that.
It was in Utah that you were the executive secretary, right?
Before we moved out, or before we got to North Carolina, I was the executive secretary.
Oh, okay.
But then
oh, cool.
I came back here and was called into the, actually I'm in the Cub Scouts as well as the Elders Quorum secretary.
Oh, cool. All right. Now you did mention something that Pat, I'm going to backtrack a little bit, because later on in the interview, I generally ask about home teaching, but I think your experience in North Carolina was obviously, and maybe you're experiencing a little bit now, obviously being in the Elders Quorum presidency, but in that you mentioned that people were assigned 8 or 9 families, and that obviously was nearly impossible to get that 100% or close to it. What was any tactic or approach you had there with such a unique problem of, I mean, I don't know if I'd call it unique, but I think many wards could assign 8 or 9 or more families. How did you go about that?
So we tried to start at the home teaching companionship level, try to have some sort of relatively consistent interviews with them just to see if they are, I mean, are they aware of all their families, any of their needs, if they're able to even get a hold of people. And then we just talk about their families. We still assigned every single person was still assigned a home teacher. But you know, more often than not, we'd say, look, here are some of your active families. I doubt they need a monthly visit, if nothing else, touch base with them. But let's focus on these individuals that could use some, you know, just some contact from the church at least, and go from there. I mean, our stake president, he was his counsel or requirement for an actual visit was whatever the extent that a family would allow. And so we would just, you know, just try to take it family by family basis and figure out what they would allow. And if we can get in there just to let them know that, hey, we're here, we are going to make contact unless you tell us not to, and just kind of go from there.
Yes. Cause I would imagine those 8 or 9 families weren't all stalwart active families.
No, absolutely not. I mean, there was, if you were lucky, if you had maybe one active family on your route and the others were, you know, either purposefully trying not to be found or just, you know, weren't always coming to church, but they were certainly there and we tried to get them involved to whatever degree we could.
Would you say like in that area or I don't know if that specific area, but inactivity was much higher than in other wards you've experienced?
I guess in that particular area, maybe a little bit more so. And we did a lot of record cleanup too, just trying to go out and make visits and just see where they were and see if we could, you know, find out where we should send their records, just so we could, you know, keep up on that and make sure we knew exactly who was under our stewardship.
Cool. Right on. So let's jump in. You've got some great key leadership principles, and I think by far as far as the notes you sent me are the most thorough than I usually get. And that's, I mean, I don't expect everybody to be thorough. You know, a lot of these leaders I interview, it's like, you're busy, just sit down for 10 minutes and think, you know, what are those five key principles that you've really taken away and are trying to apply week in and week out as you serve in a leadership capacity. But you've got links here and quotes. And so I'm really excited to jump into this. And I think those listening will benefit not only from your perspective, but also have many resources and talks and books that they can go out and grab that they can expound on some of these points. So
I hope so. I mean, like it's been said before, it's kind of being more of a pirate than a pioneer as far as these leadership principles. But these are ones that I've given a lot of thought to, or at least have had top of mind.
Yeah, I think thanks to Bishop Mikos, I'm going to change the how I lead to being a pirate in leadership or something.
Exactly.
Because that's really the essence of these interviews is that, and I think many people enjoy them because it's just nice to hear what the other guy, you know, in another part of the world's doing and how he's applying it. And so we're just recycling leadership principles, but that's because they're principles that work. So,
and that's why I'm glad I was able to find your blog and this podcast, just be able to get that exposure to all these different approaches and insights that can be found across the country and the world.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's the point. So I'm glad that's working. The first one you wrote down, the first principle is don't let management get in the way of leadership. I think that's a key principle.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, sometimes we can get caught up in a lot of the administrative tasks, and sometimes I'm more inclined to be focused on being administrative and just trying to get through the reporting and you know, just trying to do all those basic things. But because it seems more tangible sometimes, and it's a little bit easier. But this really came from a talk by Hugh Nibley, Leaders and Managers, back in the early 80s. You can find it on the BYU Speeches website.
Yeah, I'll link to it for sure.
And in it, he gave some interesting perspective, and particularly he brought up the example of two contrasting figures in the Book of Mormon, Malachi and Captain Moroni, and just emphasize, I mean, here's a very stark contrast between a true leader, where you have Captain Moroni, who's you know, of all the principles that he stood for, compared to what Amalekai is trying to accomplish. And it's kind of interesting around this time where we actually see the first use of the word management, and how Captain Moroni was ultimately trying to become anti-establishment and trying to rally the people for all that was good and holy, and trying to, you know, try to do exactly the will of God versus the opposite of what Amalekai was trying to accomplish. And ultimately, so to me, it just kind of reiterated the point of, you know, sometimes as leaders, you don't want to aspire, you don't want to please whoever's supervising you. Ultimately, you're there to serve God, and you do that by serving his children and the people that over which you have stewardship. And it can be easy to overlook that sometimes, and I don't think people do it completely to their detriment, or you know, they're not trying to not serve God, but we can miss the mark if we're not careful.
Yeah, for sure. And it makes me, I was just looking through your notes, a quote that you bring up later on, as far as, I think it was by Clay Christensen, as far as the focusing on the people. I'm scanning here. So I realized that God is in contrast to us, does not need the tools of statisticians or accountants. And then later on in the quote, and he says, his only measure of achievement is the individual. And I think that's exactly kind of what you're saying, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and as the leader, I mean, you're responsible for your spirituality, of course, but as a leader, you're also there to kind of ultimately help others come closer to Christ.
Yeah. And I know, you know, my first leadership calling was really when I was called as an elders quorum president in the student ward where I met my wife, and I was 90% a manager. And I just didn't have the experience or didn't know how to talk to a group, motivate a group. And so I spent most of my time in the office, you know, clerk's office, managing the home teaching. And I don't even know what I delegated to my counselors. And as you look back in your time in North Carolina, I mean, maybe this principle was thriving within you at that time, but do you feel like you were more a manager or a leader, or did you even, were you even conscious of that balance?
Well, I was conscious of it, and you know, it just kind of depended on the week, really. We had some strong members there that you know, we could call on last minute to do the lessons, or you know, and my counselors throughout my ministry, I had two sets of counselors, and they were both great. They all had their strengths which we relied on, and you know, we just split up the work as best we can. And sometimes, I mean, a lot of it just kind of fell on me, given timing or urgency, that sort of thing. And going back to that talk by Hugh Nibley, I mean, he brings up a good point. You have Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, and Brigham Young was known for his being a great manager as well as a great leader. So it's not like it doesn't have its place.
Yeah, sure.
Joseph Smith is certainly known for being a great leader. It's just, you know, at the end of the day, that, I mean, we still want to strive to put that leadership first before being a manager.
Yeah, I think we've probably all experienced, you know, whether in a secular job or in a church capacity, the leader who is, you know, just, you just love when he stands up and speaks. He just seems like he knows just the right scripture to share, but behind the scenes, maybe, you know, you haven't gotten that home teaching route for 4 months and you're thinking, like what's going on, right? So yeah, I think that's a great example with Brigham Young. Is he was a great manager, but also a great leader. And there's definitely a place for both, and one's not bad and the other's not, you know, super good for sure.
Absolutely.
All right. The second leadership point principle that you mentioned was remember the importance of asking the right question.
Yeah, that's right. So this was a concept that was shared with our elders quorum when I was in California. And it comes from a speech that Clayton Christensen had given at some point. And in it, he develops just the whole concept of, you know, when we approach a problem, sometimes it's important to take a step back and really figure out the question that you need to answer in order to find the right solution to provide. And he provided a great example from the scriptures where Jesus Christ comes to his disciples and says, "How think ye, if a man have 100 sheep and one of them be gone astray, doth he not leave the 99 and goeth into the mountains and seeketh that which is gone astray?" He's saying, who didn't come to church today? Where sometimes we kind of get focused on who's here. We go down our roles and mark off who's coming to church, that sort of thing. But, you know, just kind of take that, I don't know, a paradigm shift, if you will, and think about the question that really needs to be asked.
And just a clarification, Clay Christensen, I believe he's currently serving as an Area 70, but he's a Harvard professor, a business professor, very famous in the secular world with he's got several books out in the medical field. And what's the term? Disruptive innovation is sort of
innovation.
His thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The innovator. And it's kind of interesting in this talk that I'm pulling from, he started it by going back to his first days, I think when he was at Harvard as a student, and just as they were going through class and they're going through these case studies, he realized, I mean, as he was listening to his other classmates, that they had some really good insights. And he figured out, you know, they must have asked a question that led them to that particular insight. And so really he kind of switched his focus and try to figure out what is the question that they would ask in order to lead them to the insight that they're developing and how to approach those different problems. And so he's really kind of developed that. And I think it's a great principle that we could have as we go throughout, you know, just our life, our own careers, but particularly as a leader in the church. You know, sometimes, I mean, there's a lot that's asked of us and that we have to do, but if you take that time to really figure out what is the problem or the root cause or what you need to ask, I think some great insights can develop.
Yeah. And what would, I mean, if you were standing in front of a bunch of Elders Quorum presidents, what would be kind of an application example of that? Maybe in home teaching or running the Sunday Quorum meeting, any example jump to mind?
I guess if you think about home teaching, right, sometimes it's more of a, you know, sometimes we just simply ask, you know, how can I get my visits in? But really the question is what does this family really need? And sometimes it may not be just you coming in over once a month to sit down and just read out of a magazine, right? I mean, they have other needs that you just really have to think through and, you know, ask the question, like, how can you best serve them? Their ultimate need.
Yeah. And I think this is something, you know, we have such a rich culture in the church and programs have been approached the same way for years and years. And sometimes we even assume that a lot of these programs or approaches are dried out of the handbook, or we do it because it's how we're told we do it. I know, in the last couple of weeks, I've been, you know, we're kind of gearing up to start the ward conference, you know, tour in our stake.
Right.
And it was delegated to me to kind of, you know, orchestrate that, make sure the bishops know what they need to do. And for a moment, I just stopped and I stepped back and I said, I'm going to act like I've never experienced a ward conference before. And I'm just going to go straight to the handbook and see what it says to do for a ward conference. And I was shocked by how brief it is in the handbook and how much leeway we had, you know, where past state presidencies, you know, they had their approach, which was very effective. But I realized I don't have to do that, or I don't have to approach it the way the last presidency did. And, you know, maybe I can focus on a different strength of this process. And so I think it really kind of gave me pause to say, what question am I not asking myself, and what can I do to really step back and start asking the right questions so that we don't veer off too much of in just tradition or going through the motions.
Absolutely. And it's a discipline process. I mean, it's not easy trying to figure that out. You know, another good example that I think actually Brother Christensen brings up is more often than not, when we're actually, you know, thinking about callings or assignments, sometimes we default to who's the most qualified to fulfill this calling, when maybe the question should be, who will do the best job, or who really needs this calling? You know, in thinking back to when Christ started the church, right? I mean, it's not like he had a strong group of generational converts to draw from, right? I mean, these are grassroots individuals that hadn't really experienced all this before. And you think about even the early days of the Latter-day Church.
Yeah.
So, and that's just another approach, I think, that sometimes it's important that we take.
Yeah. Great points. And I love Clayton Christensen, and he's one of my dream guests on the podcast. But I'm afraid that if I ever got him to come on the podcast, I would just weep because he is so much smarter than me. I mean, I don't, obviously people listening, they can tell I'm not a genius, right? And I mean, the words and verbiages he uses, I'm just like, oh boy, I'd probably just hang up and run away and hide. But if you are listening out there, Brother Christensen, like, seriously, let's line this up. I'm sure we can find some questions I can ask that would really bless the lives of the leaders that listen. But so, mark my word, he will be on the podcast. If I do anything with this podcast, it will be interview him. So
I'm looking forward to it.
Good. All right, moving on to principle three, remember the Lord's metric.
Right. And you kind of alluded to this earlier before. And again, this is coming again from Brother Christensen. And sometimes, you know, like, it's easy for us as mortals, trying to make sense of all the information that we have. We are easy to, you know, synthesize, summarize, put things in compartments just so we can make sense of situations. So sometimes we're more inclined to, you know, categorize people quite easily into, you know, active, less active, that sort of a thing. And you know, I love the concept of I mean, I'm an accountant, so it's quite easy for me to make sure financial statements are summarized correctly and in that way. But ultimately, what Brother Christensen's trying to point out is, if you think about God's perspective, I mean, as close as we can actually think about it and try to comprehend it, ultimately, his measure of achievement is the individual. And so, again, I think it's important for us to try to step in the shoes of all the people that we are working with and serving with, to try to grasp where maybe at least where they might be coming from. And when we do that, you know, we're kind of hopefully trying to get over ourselves and hopefully putting ourselves in a better position to serve them. I love a quote that goes kind of along with this, from President Eyring, where he was said he was serving as a counselor to a district president who tried to teach him, or at least he gave him this advice. He says, when you meet someone, treat them as if they were in serious trouble, and you will be right more than half the time. And President Eyring tries to explain how he got his mind around that. But ultimately, he realized, you know, the world grows more challenging. Life is difficult. At the end of the day, the Lord, we need to realize that the Lord is our strength in our time of trouble and throughout our lives. And so when we think about that relationship that we must have ourselves as an individual with our Heavenly Father, I mean, it should be hopefully easier for us to think about it from the perspective of everybody else that we interact with it. They're on a journey just as much as we are, and a relationship with our Heavenly Father is critical. And we may or may not be able to have some sort of role in that, but hopefully we know when to get out of the way or when to be able to help.
Yeah, I think this is a crucial concept, but it's a difficult one because, like you said, especially yourself, you have an analytical background, right? You want the data, you want to analyze it, and then be able to make assumptions and conclusions from that data. And we try and do that with home teaching. And I wrote a post a few years ago called Home Teaching Visits Aren't Touchdowns, they're first downs, right? Because we don't really know what that touchdown looks like, or it's hard to recognize it when it happens. It's just suddenly you wake up and, wow, you know, that family's going to the temple today, get sealed. Like, we did something right along the way, and now they're receiving this great blessing. And so it's important to focus on that individual and almost that doctrine of becoming, right, or sanctification. But it's just hard to measure. And so a leader gets in there, wants to do a good job, but they don't know what to measure because there really isn't anything tangible to measure. You just sort of keep encouraging, keep prodding and focusing on what is changing.
Yeah. And I agree. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I don't consider myself the most outgoing person or the charismatic.
Well, you're an accountant. I mean,
exactly. Kind of fits the mold. And so it's hard to be able to, you know, reach out and make some sort of personal connection. But I guess at the end of the day, I can't forget that. I mean, it's all in the Lord's hand. So if I'm supposed to be serving him in some capacity, then I'll try to do my best to be in a position where he can just lead the way and make it happen. I mean, I wish I was, I just remember I can't remember which talk it was. Maybe it was Elder Bednar or someone, where they just mentioned there was an Elders Quorum president that had a truck and he would go out where all the other guys with trucks would be and
great
make
story.
That connection. Right. And you know,
and just waited for them to have a problem because they always did. Right.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
Great.
So, I mean, I'm not like that, but hey, at least he was in tune for the Spirit to understand that's where he could go. And hopefully, leaders in the church, we can try to be that in tune and hopefully, good things could happen.
Yeah. Cool. Next point, which I think is crucial and a fun one too, unstring your bow.
Yeah, no, this is one that I wish I could say I always follow. I mean, you could saw my emails coming to you at almost at midnight, but basically this comes from Joseph
I did
Smith,
not notice where, that. Oh boy.
Where Joseph Smith said, this is coming from Truman G. Matson's book, Joseph the Prophet. Basically he says, Joseph Smith learned to relax, and when chided for it, he commented that if a man has a bow and keeps it constantly strung tight, it will soon lose its spring. The bow must be unstrung. And so I think it's a great point there where, you know, it can be easy if we could run ourselves ragged between, you know, between church callings and work and family responsibilities, that sometimes we got to find our own release, and either whether that's a good night's rest or going out and exercising and you know, just doing something. I mean, it's still okay to be able to take care of yourself. And I think it's actually critical that we do. Otherwise, we lose that capacity to have a fresh mind, a quickened spirit, if you will, to be able to help people that they might have an urgent crisis, or your family where they need you to be on top of your game, and even your work where you're supporting your family.
Yeah. And I think this is obviously important on an individual level, but also I'll also comment that it's important on a group level or a presidency level. I know, you know, when we were called as a stake presidency, we had been in meetings together, myself and the stake president and the other counselor. We knew each other's name, but we just sort of looked at each other like, you know, I don't really know you. Like, I don't know what you do for fun. And so one of the other counselor in the presidency, he's got a family cabin, and just said, hey, why don't we set a time in a few weeks? We'll take our wives and family up to this cabin and let's just hang out for a night. And we did that. And it was like so bonding and unifying that we kind of unstrung our presidency bow and said, you know, let's just relax for a bit.
I love that. I'm glad you could do that. And I wish I would have done something or some of those things a little bit more often, either with my presidency or even with the quorum, where, you know, you try to change things up instead of, you know, playing basketball, do some volleyball or soccer, or trying to get everybody else that has other interests and, you know, just trying to be a little bit more relaxing environment.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think as many listeners know, I'm a big proponent of very effective meetings, and I'm of the opinion that few meetings need to last longer than an hour. And so it can be very rigid and meeting and, you know, let's get to the point and move forward. But also it's important to even take time in those meetings, just sort of kick back or take the first 15 minutes and talk about, you know, the latest movie you saw or how the family's doing and have some good belly laughs because it's so unifying. It's more unifying than I think we think. And, you know, we want to be all business and not do anything in vain and be, you know, and dedicate ourselves to what we're doing. But, you know, I think those moments where we can just step back and laugh together and relax are crucial. Absolutely crucial.
Absolutely. And just as a side note, as you're talking about meetings, one of the interesting things when I was first called into the Elders Quorum presidency, I remember talking to my uncle who I lived near at the time there in North Carolina. And he had told me about his experience here in Utah. He was in the Elders Quorum presidency. And he said he loved it because they never had any meetings. Basically, they would just go out and visit people, and they would have their meetings as they walked from house to house trying to talk to people. And I thought that's kind of an effective use of time. It's harder, obviously, when you're in North Carolina and have to drive 30 minutes to the next yeah. house. But at least, I mean, you could have the meeting in the car as you're driving and you know, maximize that time there and also kind of get to know each other more on a personal level as you spend that time with each other.
Cool. Right on. All right. Last principle, which is more like three principles in one, but it is remember Hinckley's big three. Tell us the big three of President Hinckley.
Yeah. So, again, this is coming from Truman G. Madsen telling it's found in his biography. Basically, when mission presidents were called during his time on the missionary committee, he offered these three one sentence bits of counsel. First is follow your impressions. Second, read the Book of Mormon. And finally, when making decisions of judgment, err, if you must err, on the side of mercy. And, you know, I think those are actually very powerful, if nothing else, to fall back on when you're in the heat of a moment. Obviously, that's directed to mission presidents, but I can't think of another leader that can't truly follow those bits of counsel. Because I remember when I was an executive secretary, I mean, I would even sit on disciplinary councils at the time. And you know, I think that's a hard situation to be in, especially as the bishop. But, you know, you are in that position to make those decisions of judgment. And sometimes you just have to rely on a situation where if you are going to err, it's a good side, or it's a good way to side on the error of, or on the side of mercy.
Yeah. Great point. Well, the great quotes, scriptures, references, I'll put all that on the show notes, as they're called. But let's move on and maybe just talk about in the context of your current calling as a secretary in the Elder's Quorum Presidency. And you mentioned you're an assistant scout leader. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm an assistant pack leader for the Cub Scouts too.
And so what is that, a one night a week type of commitment?
It's a couple nights actually during the month or more if needed. I mean, it's basically pack meeting and our Cub Scout committee meetings and then wherever else I need to be involved with. So it's not as time intensive, and it's great. They called me when my son was just getting into Cub Scouts, so I was able to spend additional time with him. And so I've enjoyed being with the boys in that regard.
So in terms of your Elder's Quorum Presidency calling, maybe explain just what's your typical week starting Sunday morning all the way till Saturday night.
So it's basically, I mean, Sunday we try to avoid having a lot of meetings just because the Elder's Quorum President's already going to be in and hit all of his Sunday meetings. And we just kind of do our little huddle at church and on things that come up. And then we will have our meeting as an Elder's Quorum Presidency during the week. And then if we need to go make a visit or two, we'll go out and do that. So it's not as intensive, especially as the secretary. I think the Elder's Quorum President here, he shields us with a lot of that other than assignments where he delegates. And then it's, you know, just making sure people are ready to do their lessons. And then, you know, following up on home teaching reports, that sort of a thing.
Cool. And as the secretary, what are you doing? A lot of phone calls, a lot of note taking? What are your pillar responsibilities?
Yeah. So we've got, it's one of the tools I use is to make my life a little bit easier administratively. I use Google Forms. So I send out basically an email at the end of each month where each companionship can get it. They can click on their companionship and it'll bring them to their families, and they can just go through and click on who they visited and provide some notes if we need to know about anything. And then we'll just split up whoever hasn't reported. And that way we can just kind of focus on, and that's just the administrative task. And then we can go out and focus on whoever needs it instead of spending time chasing down home teaching reports.
Okay. So a lot of your responsibility is just collecting that information, those reports.
Yeah, exactly. And then the presidency tries to follow up with the individuals themselves. And I mean, I'll help obviously and direct them so they know exactly who needs to be followed up with. And go from there.
So you have me intrigued now. So you use Google Forms, which I'm very familiar with. And so does everybody in the quorum get the same form, or how do they click on their companionship?
So everybody has the same splash page. It just shows up in their email, and then they can just click on their companion and then just go from there, start reporting. And so, I mean, not that anybody would ever purposefully try to report for something else, but you can see who reported, when they reported, and then which families they reported. So, I mean, I have to go in there, and I'm not completely computer savvy, so I wish I could feed this all into the online clerk resources so I can input it. But I just look at the Google Forms and go online where the MLS is now on the online format and just input those the visits that have happened.
Yeah, cool. Well, I may have to if you have a way of sending me some screenshots or something just to get a better idea of what. Sorry, my alarm's going off here. Better idea of how that's done or you step by step or something. I think others would be interested in how you do that because, you know, as you know, most Elder's Quorum presidencies are looking for a better way streamline that process of collecting information.
Yeah, I'll send you the actual form so you can see it in your email. And if anybody else wants it, just reach out to you or to me, and I'm happy to to share that.
Let's do it. Cool. Well, great. Now, apart from that, as far as technology or tools or apps you use or that you did use in your past callings, I know the world is changing so quickly. Maybe there weren't as in abundance when you were the Elder's Quorum president, but any other unique tools that your quorum or ward uses?
Other than, I guess one cool thing that we do as a presidency, when we look at the home teaching routes together. And our stake here we have the Apple TV connected to our TVs. And so
Oh, cool.
What I'll do is I'll just take my iPad or even my computer And I just, and I've put all of my, the home teaching routes and home teachers and families we need to assign or new home teachers that, that have moved into the ward all in the spreadsheet. So I can just move them around and we can look at it together on the computer screen. So it's kind of like a digital transfer board, if you will.
Yeah.
Going back to the mission days. So it's pretty nice, I guess.
Cool. Oh, that's a great tip. All right. Well, Adam, this has been fantastic. Another thing I wanted to mention is you, in your time out in San Francisco, you served, was it in the same, you, or you were in the same ward as Greg McKeown. Is that how you say his name?
With Greg McKeown. Yeah.
McKeown. Sure. Yes. And he, those of you who don't know, he is the co-author to Liz Wiseman's Multipliers book, which I'm always raving about, which everybody should read as a leader. And then also went on, does he teach at Stanford? Isn't that what he does out there?
He does a lot of different consulting.
I mean,
I'm sure he's involved in Silicon Valley, right? Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
And I know he's currently serving as a bishop. I think you're the one that, that told me that, but he wrote the book, Essentialism. So you emailed me, said, "Hey, have you looked at this book that Greg McKeown wrote?" And I'm like, "Oh, I guess I didn't. I didn't put the two and two together. He was also the co-author. I had heard of the book, so I went out and grabbed the book, and I've already read it twice because it is so good. So that's another bonus for this episode. Go out and get Essentialism, and I am working on getting him on the podcast, but." Of course, I'm probably being filtered out in his many flawless systems of the emails or whatever. So I have to maybe like rent a plane and fly a banner in front of his house or something and say, please be on my podcast. Because as a bishop and these principles he talks about in this book, it would be so fascinating for him to talk in the context of church service. So I thank you for recommending that book. And I pass that recommendation on to everybody listening. Essentialism. Is a fantastic read, and definitely get it. So with that said, this has been a great interview, great tips. As tradition is, as you've served in the church in these various capacities, how has your experience serving as a leader made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
And I love that. That's a great question. I guess at the end of the day, it's really made me realize on whom I must rely. And, you know, sometimes I'm more inclined to, you know, I can figure it out myself. I can, it's all on me, but what it's done is made me realize, you know, I can have a much closer personal relationship with my Savior as I do the basic things that we need to do through studying the scriptures, spending time with my family, teaching them, going to church. You know, it's just kind of made me more aware of the utmost importance it is to have that kind of a relationship with him and make sure I spend my resources trying to develop that relationship.
That concludes my interview with Adam Barrow. Fantastic individual. I appreciate his friendship and I'm looking to get to know him more. And again, if there's anybody in Salt Lake who wants to get together, even just call me, talk about leading LDS, what you like, any suggestions you have, I'm open to that. Or email's fine too, or a Facebook post or an anonymous hate letter, you know, whatever, that works. But I definitely want to say how appreciative I am and touched as I've put out that Patreon campaign where individuals can just contribute a certain amount of money a month to leading LDS and what we're trying to do. I've been more surprised than I thought it would be as far as the feeling I've had towards creating since then, knowing that we have supporters there, that a simple dollar is coming from many people and that I'm not held back on what content I can create. I don't have to think, well, I can do more episodes, but you know, I don't want to spend more, you know, or is the money there? I don't know. It's sort of on my shoulders to do that. And so to see that come in, I sure appreciate it. And so if you have enjoyed leading LDS even a little bit, like consider just going to leadinglds.com/help and going to the Patreon page and contributing just a dollar a month. Like I promise you people, I'm not trying to get filthy rich off of leading LDS. Okay. I'm just trying to create a very quality resource that's consistent enough to bless your lives with leadership. And as I get emails from people across the country that say, hey, I'm using these principles that I'm learning from other leaders, or you said this or that, and it's really blessed my life, that's what I'm trying to accomplish. So just a dollar. I know it's a pain. You got to like go to this page and get out your credit card and enter it all in there. Again, I'm not trying to get rich off of this. I'm just needing a dollar from you. That's it. And if you feel so inclined to give more, you know, we have people giving $10 every month. And I mean, it's such an incredible blessing. And I'm grateful for that support and all you're doing. And so consider that. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.